Welcome. This is the online course on the Nibbana Sermons 1 to 11 by Bhikkhu Katakuranda Nyanananda, hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Barrett Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And today we are into Sermon 5. But before coming to that, I first like to look at some of the points made in the, as usually, so very vivid and interesting discussion on the forum. One comment by Jeff Harlin was on the translation of dukkha as suffering. And he says that the passage makes much more sense with translating dukkha as unsatisfactoriness. And I can only wholeheartedly agree with that. I often think that our understanding of early Buddhist thought suffers because of the translation of dukkha as suffering. Then Kim Allen said that the fundamental assumption of science is that there's a neutral objective observer who can witness experience without affecting it or being affected by it. Indeed, any type of observation that does not fulfill these criteria is not considered valid. But then the very nature of dependency shows that no such observer is possible. That is indeed the case. And Margit Bormann added that the idea that there is no such thing as an objective observer also comes up in quantum physics. So this is one of the points where early Buddhist thought and quantum physics are in close agreement. Letizia Baglioni, she said that in fact I have always found the presentation of Paticca-samuppada in terms of a chain unsatisfactory. And she says that the image I get is not that of a chain reaction, but some sort of revolving transparent polyhedron. And I just thought that was a very, found that a very useful idea. And Venerable Dhammadina commented on my demonstrating how time is not a pre-existing container with the ruler getting stuck halfway through by hitting the bottom of the cup. It occurred to me that it is not really possible to fit Paticca-samuppada, the ruler, within a linear temporal model, the cup, simply because the time dimension of Paticca-samuppada is not linear but vortex-like. I also thought that the later tradition's classification of time as an unconditioned asankhata phenomenon not subject to the three characteristics might be a scholastic attempt to make sense of the absence of time in the scheme of dependent arising, having lost sight of its being the other side of the coin of conditionality and change. And Malik Samarasinghe said, also in relation to my demonstration I made in the beginning of the last lecture, that setting down the finely crafted but rigid ruler and the most useful but restraining cup and realizing the immense range of application that opens up with dependent arising applied non-linearly to samsara of the present moment and to multiple lifetimes is emancipating. I'm very glad that my little, my little playing around with the ruler and the cup has found so much appreciation, and that I was able to convey the main ideas of my own understanding of the relationship of Paticca-samuppada through to time and timelessness. So now it's time to get into Sermon 5. Itang santang itang panitang yadidang sabba sankhara samato sab upari patinissaggo tanhakkhayo virago nirodho nibbanam. This is peaceful, this is excellent, namely the stilling of all preparations, the relinquishment of all assets, the destruction of craving, detachment, cessation, extinction. With the permission of the Most Venerable Great Preceptor and the assembly of the Venerable Meditative Monks, Towards the end of our last sermon, we discussed, to some extent, a special mode of attention regarding the four objects of contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta: body, feelings, mind, and mind objects. That discussion might have revealed a certain middle path indicated by the Buddha. We drew attention to a thematic paragraph occurring throughout the Satipatthana Sutta, which outlines a method of using objects and concepts for Satipatthana meditation without dogmatic involvement. This leads the meditator to a particular kind of attitude, summed up by the concluding phrase, "He abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world. Anissito cha viharati na cha kinchi loke upadhyati." By way of clarification, we brought in the simile of a scaffolding for a building, that here the concepts only serve as a scaffolding for building up mindfulness and knowledge. Talking about the scaffolding, we are reminded of two different attitudes, namely, the attitude of leaning onto and dwelling in the scaffolding itself, and the enlightened attitude of merely utilizing it for the purpose of erecting a building. For further explanation of this technique, we may take up the two terms paramasana and sammasana. It might be better to distinguish the meanings of these two terms also with the help of a simile. As for a simile, let us take up the razor, which is such a useful requisite in our meditative life. There's a certain special way in sharpening a razor. Comment: I just wanted to explain to those who might not be familiar with it. This is, the Venerable is speaking about the type of razor used in old times and which is still accustomed to be used in the forest tradition, which is like a long blade and then a handle. And so one has to sharpen it on a stone in order to be able to shave one's head, which as monastics we have to do very regularly. End of comment. There's a certain special way in sharpening a razor. With the idea of sharpening the razor, if one grabs it tightly and rubs it on the sharpening stone, it will only become blunt. Paramasana, grasping, grabbing, is something like that. What then is the alternative? A more refined and softer approach is required, as meant by the term sammasana. Comment: I think the Venerable author is here trying to build a bridge over to sammasana jnana, the next of the insight knowledges. We have been moving through nama-rupa pariccheda and paccaya parigraha, and I think he's here just pointing over in the direction of the next in the series of knowledges in the progress of insight. End of comment. There is a proper mode of doing it. One has to hold the razor in a relaxed way, as if one is going to throw it away. One holds it lightly, ready to let go of it at any time, but of course with mindfulness. The wrist also is not rigid but relaxed. Hand is supple at the joints and easy to swing. Then, with that readiness, one sharpens the razor, sliding it smoothly on the stone. First up, 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 then down, 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 and then up, down, up, down, up, down. The third combined movement ensures that those parts of the blade still untouched by the stone will also get duly sharpened. It is in the same manner that the razor of insight wisdom has to be whetted on the sharpening stone of the Satipatthana Sutta. Inward, 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 outward, 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 inward, outward, inward, outward. Or else, rising, 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 ceasing, 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 rising, ceasing, rising, ceasing. This is an illustration for the method of reflection or sammasana introduced by the Buddha in the Satipatthana Sutta. words and concepts have to be made use of for attaining Nibbana. But here the aim is only the upbuilding of mindfulness and knowledge. Once their purpose is served, they can be dismantled without being a bother to the mind. This is the significance of the concluding phrase, "He abides independent and does not cling to anything in the world." There's another sutta in which the Buddha has touched upon this same point in particular. It is the Samudaya Sutta in the Satipatthana Samyutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. In that sutta, the Buddha has proclaimed the arising and the going down of the four foundations of mindfulness. He begins by saying, "Monks, I shall teach you the arising and the going down of the four foundations of mindfulness. Chatunnang bhikkave satipatthananang samudayanche attagamanche dissesami." He goes on to say, "Kocha bhikkave kayas samudayum. Ahara samudaya kayas samudayo. Ahara niruddha kayas attagamo." What, monks, is the arising of the body? With the arising of nutriment is the arising of the body, and with the cessation of nutriment is the going down of the body. Similarly, passa samudaya vedananang samudayo, passa niruddha vedananang attagamo. With the arising of contact is the arising of feeling, and with the cessation of contact is the going down of feeling. And then, nama rupa samudaya cittas samudayo, nama rupa niruddha cittas attagamo. With the arising of name and form is the rising of the mind, and with the cessation of name and form is the going down of the mind. And lastly, manasikara samudaya dhammanang samudayo, manasikara niruddha dhammanang attagamo. With the rising of attention is the rising of mind objects, and with the ceasing of attention is the going down of mind objects. Comment: just like to offer the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi, because I will teach you the origination and the passing away of the four establishments of mindfulness. And what, bhikkhus, is the origination of the body? With the origination of nutriment, there is the origination of the body. With the cessation of nutriment, there is the passing away of the body. With the origination of contact, there is the origination of feeling. With the cessation of contact, there is the passing away of feeling. With the origination of name and form, there is the origination of the mind. With the cessation of name and form, there is the passing away of mind. With the origination of attention, there is the origination of phenomena. With the cessation of attention, there is the passing away of phenomena. And below I just pasted in the Chinese parallel, which makes the same basic statement. This too is an important discourse, well worth remembering, because here the Buddha is dealing with the rising and cessation, or rising and going down, of the four objects used for establishing mindfulness. As we know, the concept of nutriment in this Dhamma is much broader than the worldly concept of food. It does not imply merely the ordinary food, for which the term used is kabalinkara ahara, or material food. Taken in a deeper sense, it includes the other three kinds of nutriment as well, namely passa, or contact, manasanchetana, or volition, and vijnana, or consciousness. These four together account for the concept of body as such. Therefore, due to these four, there comes to be a body, and with the cessation, the body ends. So also in the case of feeling. We all know that the rising of feeling is due to contact. The reference to name and form in this context might not be clear enough at once, due to various definitions of name and form, or nama rupa. Here, the reason for the rising of the mind is said to be name and form. Mind is said to arise because of name and form, and it is supposed to go down with the cessation of name and form. Comment, Venerable Nyanananda does not further expand on this, and so I just like to offer my own personal take, and this I relate I see here Nama Rupa particularly pointing the factor out of name that I think is of particular relevance here is volition, chetana. So, because volition, chetana and chitta are even etymologically related. And so I understand the point to be that the volition that is born out of the material experience, the experience of matter together with its mental processing through name, is in particular what impacts, originates, or leads to the rising of the mind. And I relate this to the need in the Satipatthana Sutta when contemplating citta to go from the level of actual thought experience to the lower level or more internal level of the actual current of the mental state underlying it. Say something is going on in my mind because I got upset and I'm going like, so-and-so should not have said that and next time I will. And as the mind keeps elaborating, the task is to go down to this lower level and just recognize, Analayo, you are being angry. And this recognition has a lot to do with the basic thrust of the mind, and this is where chetana comes in, the volition part. So my personal take on this statement that the arising of the third object of the third Satipatthana relates to name and form is in particular name and form as they build up, like in that simile with the fingers, where the volitional finger is the middle finger, the one that really sticks out. This is where name all comes together in this pointing out of volition. This is just my personal take on it because the Venerable Nyanananda does not further expand on this topic. End of comment. The fact that the mind objects arise due to attention is noteworthy. All the mind objects mentioned in the fourth section of contemplation arise when there is attention, and they go down when attention is not there. In other words, attention makes objects out of them. This way, we are reminded that apart from making use of these words and concepts for the purpose of attaining Nibbana, there's nothing worth holding on to or clinging to dogmatically. Comment, I again like to offer my own personal understanding here. The contemplation of Dhammas in the comparative perspective by studying the different canonical discourse versions and parallels to the Satipatthana Sutta reduces to just two contemplations. Contemplation of hindrances and contemplation of the awakening factors. In fact, even the hindrances are not mentioned in all three versions. In one version they are just briefly listed and in a different place. But as I have discussed in my perspectives on Satipatthana, I believe that we should count the hindrances in. And so when we get this basic idea of contemplation of Dhammas being the overcoming of the hindrances and the cultivation of the awakening factors, then the idea of the fourth Satipatthana becomes really the monitoring of the mind in its progress towards awakening. And that, to my personal understanding, gives a very clear thrust and direction towards this fourth Satipatthana. And then the question of attention, of manasikara, really becomes one of ayoniso and yoniso manasikara. Wise, thorough, radical attention is opposite. Then the hindrances arise because of ayoniso manasikara. Unwise, unradical, lack of thorough attention. And the awakening factors arise because of yoniso manasikara. This is just, again, my personal take on this statement that the fourth Satipatthana relates to attention manasikara. End of comment. So if a meditator works with this aim in mind, he will be assured of a state of mind that is independent and clinging free, anicca anupadana. One marvelous quality of the Buddha's teaching emerges from this discussion. A mind object is something that the mind hangs on to, as the connotations of the word aramana, compound alambana, suggest. But because of the mode of insight wisdom outlined here, because of the middle path approach, even the tendency to hang on is finally done away with, and the object is penetrated through. Despite the above connotations of hanging on, aramana, the object is transcended. Transcendence in its highest sense is not a case of surpassing, as is ordinarily understood. Instead of leaving behind, it penetrates through. Here then we have a transcendence that is in itself a penetration. So the terms anicca and anupadana seem to have a significance of their own. More of it comes to light in quite a number of other suttas, particularly in the Dvaitanupassana Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. We come across the following two verses, which throw more light on these two terms. Anissito na chalati nissito cha upadiyam itta bhavanyatta bhavang saṃsāraṃ nāti vattati etanādīna vaññatvā nissayesu mahabhayam anissito anupadāno satu bhikkhu paribbhaje. The unattached one wavers not, but the one attached, clinging on, does not go get beyond saṃsāraṃ, which is an alternation between a thisness and an otherwiseness. Knowing this parallel, the great danger in attachments or supports, let the monk fare along mindfully, resting on nothing, clinging to nothing. Comment, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. One who is independent does not quake, but one who is dependent, clinging to things, does not transcend saṃsāra, with its becoming thus, becoming otherwise. Having known this danger, there is great peril in dependencies. Independent without clinging, a bhikkhu should wander mindfully. End of comment. Caught up in the dichotomy of samsaric existence, which alternates between thisness and otherwiseness, one is unable to transcend it, so long as there is attachment and clinging. Nisayas are the supports that encourage clinging in the form of dogmatic adherence to views. Seeing the peril and the danger in them, a mindful monk has no recourse to them. This gives one an idea of the attitude of an arahant. His mind is free from enslavement to the conjoined pairs of relative concepts. This fact is borne out by certain canonical statements, which at first sight might appear as riddles. The last two sections of the Sutta Nipata, the Attakavagga and the Parayanavagga in particular, contain verses which are extremely deep. In the Attakavagga, one often comes across apparently contradictory pairs of terms, side by side. About the arahant, it is said that he neither grasps nor gives up. Nādeti na nirassati. There is nothing taken up or rejected by him. Attaṃ niraktaṃ nahi tassa atti. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. He does not take, does not reject. And nothing is taken up or rejected by him. End of comment. By the way, the word attaṃ in this context is derived from ādāta, ā and dā, by syncopation. It should not be mistaken as a reference to atta or soul. Similarly, nirata is from as, to throw, nirasta, conveying the idea of giving up or putting down. There is nothing taken up or given up by the arahant. Other such references to the arahant's attitude are naragaragi naviragaratto. He is neither attached to attachment nor attached to detachment. Nahi so rajati no virajati. He is neither attached nor detached. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Not excited by lust or attached to this passion, and he becomes neither passionate nor dispassionate. End of comment. It is in order to explain why such references are used that we took all this trouble to discuss at length the significance of such terms as Nisaya. Probably due to a lack of understanding in this respect, the deeper meanings of such suttas have got obscured. Not only that, even textual corruption through distorted variant readings has set in, because they appeared like riddles. However, the deeper sense of the suttas sometimes emerges from certain strikingly strange statements, like the following found in the Kajaniya Sutta of the Samyutta Nikaya. The reference here is to the Arahant. Ayam bhuchyati bhikkhave bhikkhuni va achinati nu apachinati. Apachinitva tito neva pajahati no upadiyati. Pajahitva tito neva viseneti na usseneti. Visenitva tito neva vidhupeti na sandhupeti. Monks, such a monk is called one who neither amasses nor diminishes. Already diminished as he is, he neither gives up nor grasps. Already given up as he is, he neither disbands nor binds together. Already disbanded as he is, he neither exercises nor propitiates. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. This is called Bhikkhus, a noble disciple who neither builds up nor dismantles, but who abides having dismantled. Who neither abandons nor clings, but who abides having abandoned. Who neither scatters nor amasses, but who abides having scattered. Who neither extinguishes nor kindles, but who abides having extinguished. In the reference to a noble disciple here in this translation seems to be a minor error. I checked the different Asian editions. All of them actually read bhikkhu, neva achinati na apachinati. And I think this is something that easily happens. I myself also went translating from the Chinese, because the Arya Savaka, the noble disciple, has been mentioned in the previous passage, and so on. Sometimes unwittingly just doesn't realize that there has been a change in terminology. And it anyway does not affect the meaning of the passage, because in the discourse the noble disciple and the bhikkhu are used interchangingly to refer to the same person. End of comment. Even to one who does not understand the language, the above quotation would sound enigmatic. Even the rendering of the terms used here is not an easy matter, because of the nuances they seem to convey. We could perhaps say that such a monk neither amasses or accumulates nor diminishes. Since he is already diminished, presumably as regards the five aggregates, he neither abandons nor grasps anew. Since the giving up is complete, he neither binds together or enlists, note the word sena, army, nor disbands. Disbanding, if not disarmament, being complete, there is neither exercising or smoking out, nor propitiating or inviting. The coupling of these terms and their peculiar employment is suggestive of the Arahant's freedom from the dichotomy. In the Brahmanavanga of the Dhammapada too, we come across a similar enigmatic verse. Yasa paranga parangva para paranna vijjati vitaddarang visangyutantam tamahang brumi brahmanam. From there is neither a farther shore, nor a hither shore, nor boat, who is undistressed and unfettered. Him I call a Brahmin. Comment, translation by K.R. Norman. For whom there is neither the far shore, nor the near shore, nor boat, free from distress and without connections. Him I call a Brahmin. End of comment. In this context, the word Brahmana refers to the Arahant. Here too it is said that the Arahant has neither a farther shore, nor a hither shore, nor both. This might sometimes appear as a problem. Our usual concept of an Arahant is of one who has crossed over the ocean of samsara and is standing on the other shore. but here is something enigmatic. We come across a similar sutta in the Sutta Nipata also, namely its very first, the Uraga Sutta. The extraordinary feature of this sutta is the recurrence of the same refrain throughout its 17 verses. The refrain is, So bhikkhu jahati urparam urgo jinnam iva tachan puranam. That monk forsakes the hither and the thither, like a snake its slough that doth wither. The simile of the slough, or the worn-out skin of the snake, is highly significant. To quote one instance, Yo nanjagama bhavesu saram vichinang pumpam eva udumbaresu so bhikkhu jahati urparam urgo jinnam eva tacham puranam. That monk who sees no essence in existence, like one seeking flowers in udumbara trees, will give up the hither as well as the thither, like the snake its slough that doth wither. Comment translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. One who finds no core in states of existence, as one seeking flowers in udumbara trees, finds none. That bhikkhu gives up the here and the beyond, as a serpent sheds its old worn-out skin. End of comment. The arahant has abandoned his attachment to existence. As such, he is free from the bondage of those conjoined terms in worldly usage. So the arahant looks at the worldly usage in the same way as a snake would turn back and look at the worn-out skin it has sloughed off. Sometimes we see a snake moving about with the remnant of its slough hanging on. We might even think that the snake is carrying its slough around. It is the same in the case of the arahants. Now there's this term, Saupadisesa Nibbana Dhatu. Taking the term at its face value, some might think that the clinging is not yet over for the arahants, that there's still a little bit left. The arahant, though he has attained release and realized Nibbana, so long as he is living in the world, has to relate to the external objects in the world, somehow through his five senses, making use of them. Seeing it, some might conclude that it is because of some residual clinging. But we have to understand this in the light of the simile of the worn-out skin. In the case of the arahant too, the slough of skin is still hanging on. As a sidelight, we might cite a remark of Venerable Sariputta. Imina putika yena attiyami harayami jikutinchami. I am harassed and repelled by this body. I am ashamed of it. This is because the body is for him something already abundant. All this goes to show that the arahant has an unattached, unclinging attitude. Comment. Yeah, it might not be immediately evident how such a statement of being harassed and repelled by the body expresses unattachment and lack of clinging. In fact, the same expression is also used in the famous episode where a group of monks have such feelings of atiyami, harayami, jikuchami towards the body that they actually commit suicide. I have studied this in detail with a comparative study of the different versions, and I will make available that article for reading. It's the mass suicide of monks in discourse and Vinaya literature. It's a very long article, and I think only the first part of it is relevant here. And I also looked in that context at this statement attributed to Venerable Sariputta, and it's found similarly in the parallel versions. And I believe it needs to be somewhat contextualized. And the context is that he's being unjustly accused, and so he's in a way the intention is to point out that he would never slight another companion in the holy life, and that he's not attached to his body, but the way this is formulated really needs to be understood properly, and not read literally as a recommendable attitude towards the body, I think. End of comment. Linguistic usage, which is a special feature of existence, is enlivened by the cravings, conceits and views with which it is grasped. Worldlings thrive on it, whereas the Arahants are free from it. This is the upshot of the above discussion on the terms anusaya and nisaya. Yet another important term that should receive attention in any discussion on Nibbana is asava. This is because the Arahant is often called a keen asavan, one whose asavas are extinct. Asava kayu, extinction of asavas, is an epithet of Nibbana. So the distinct feature of an Arahant is his extinction of asavas. Now, what does asava mean? In ordinary life, this word is used to denote fermentation or liquor that has got fermented for a long time. If there's even a dreg of ferment in a vessel, it is enough to cause fermentation for any suitable raw material put into it. So also are the asavas. They are like the residual dregs of the ebullient mass of defilements in beings, which have undergone fermentation for a long, long time in samsara. Comment. The term asava has been discussed in Buddhist scholarship, and there have been the suggestion that it is a maladroit adaptation of Jain terminology, because the basic connotation of the term is of something flowing in. And so the allegation is that this fits the usage of the term by the Jains, where there is indeed the idea that there's some almost physical substance that flows in onto the soul through karma to any kind of needs, and hence the need to remove this physical influx, influence through ascetic practices. But so these scholars state this certain sense does not work for the Buddhist usage, and hence they conclude that it is a borrowing from the Jains. And I replied to that in an article called Purification in Early Buddhist Discourse and Buddhist Ethics, which I will also make available on the forum, where I argue that this is not a convincing statement, because the idea of an influx, an influence on the mind, is what I see as a predominant connotation of asava in his early Buddhist usage, and the Venerable Jnanananda, in fact, will bring that out in more detail in the later part of this sermon. End of comment. Very often, asavas are said to be of three types, three kinds, as kamasava, bhavasava, and avijjasava. The term asava in this context is usually rendered as influxes. We may understand them as certain intoxicating influences, which create a world of sense desire, a stupor that gives a notion of existence and leads to ignorance. These influxes are often said to have the nature of infiltrating into the mind. Sometimes a fourth type of influxes, dittasava, is also mentioned, but this can conveniently be subsumed under avijjasava. Comment. Yeah, the dittasava actually only occurs in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta and only in some editions also. So it is, as far as I'm able to see, clearly a later development. And so the suggestion by Venerable Jnanananda that it could just be subsumed under avijjasava makes a lot of sense. End of comment. The extinction of influxes becomes a distinctive characteristic of an Arahant, as it ensures complete freedom. One could be said to have attained complete freedom only if one's mind is free from these influxes. It is because these influxes are capable of creating intoxication again and again. The immense importance of the extinction of influxes and how it accounts for the worthiness of an arahant is sometimes clearly brought out. The ultimate aim of the Buddha's teaching is one that in other systems of thought is generally regarded as attainable only after death. The Buddha, on the other hand, showed a way to its realization here and now. As a matter of fact, even Brahmins like Pokkarasati went about saying that it is impossible for a human being to attain something supramundane. Katangi nama manusa bhuto uttari manusa dhamma alamarya jnana dasana visesang nyasativa dhakativa sachiva karisati. How can one as a human being know, see, or realize the supramundane state, an extraordinary knowledge and vision befitting the noble ones? They thought that such a realization is possible only after death. Immortality in other systems of thought is always an after-death experience. Comment? Yeah, I will also offer yet another article that I wrote for the Encyclopedia of Buddhism on Uttari Manusa Dhamma on the significance of this term. But besides announcing that article, I also wanted to express my appreciation for the point made by the Venerable Jnanananda that the deathless in early Buddhist thought is realized while one is still alive and not something that only comes after one, after death. It's a very powerful distinction. End of comment. Now, the realization of the extinction of influxes, on the other hand, gives a certain assurance about the future. It is by this extinction of influxes that one wins to the certitude that there is no more birth after this. Kina jati, extinct is birth. Certitude about something comes only with realization. In fact, the term sanchikiriya implies the seeing with one's own eyes, as the word for eye, akshi, is implicit in it. However, everything cannot be verified by seeing with one's own eyes. The Buddha has pointed out that there are four ways of realization or verification. Chattaro me bhikkave sanchikaraniya dhamma katame chattaro ati bhikkave dhamma kayena sanchikaraniya ati bhikkave dhamma satiya sanchikaraniya ati bhikkave dhamma chakkuna sanchikaraniya ati bhikkave dhamma panyaya sanchikaraniya. Monks, there are these four realizable things. What for? There are things, monks, that are realizable through the body. There are things, monks, that are realizable through memory. There are things, monks, that are realizable through the eye. There are things, monks, that are realizable through wisdom. Comment in the translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Monks, bhikkhus, there are these four things to be realized. What for? There are things to be realized by the body. There are things to be realized by memory. There are things to be realized by the eye. And there are things to be realized by wisdom. And even though this discourse does not have a parallel in the Chinese Agamas, when evaluating such absence, we need to keep in mind that we do not have a complete collection of four Chinese agamas from the same school, but much rather individual agamas from different schools. So we don't have a complete set, and due to the differing distribution of discourses over four agamas within different schools, there is always something that kind of falls through the gaps. But we have the Sanghitipariyaya, it's a very early work of the Sarvastivada canonical Abhidharma collection, which has quite a number of sutra quotations. It just quotes from a discourse. And in one such discourse quotation gives the same four dimensions of realization, aspects of realization. And I've just pasted this in here. And I also like to briefly comment on the first of these, the translation by the body or through the body is a somewhat literal translation of the Pali Kayena. And the instrumental Kayena in such context means direct realization. In fact, I would prefer the translation direct. It refers to direct experience. And that it does not refer to the physical body becomes quite clear when the same expression is used for the immaterial attainments that are realized by the body, kayena, or touched by the body, kayena, actually realized directly, experienced directly. In fact, the Venerable Jnanananda continues to point out that the first of these four modes of realization refers to the the eight deliverances, and these comprise the immaterial spheres. So this cannot be experienced by the physical body. End of comment. By way of explanation, the Buddha says that the things realizable through the body are the eight deliverances. And things realizable through memory are one's former habitations. The things realizable through the eye are the death and rebirth of beings. And what is realizable through wisdom is the extinction of influxes. One's former lives cannot be seen with one's own eyes by running into the past. It is possible only by purifying one's memory and directing it backwards. Similarly, the death and rebirth of beings can be seen as if with one's fleshly eye, with the divine eye, by those who have developed it. So also the fact of extirpating all influxes is to be realized by wisdom and not by any other means. The fact that the influxes of sensuality, existence, ignorance, and views will not flow in again can be verified only by wisdom. That is why special mention is made of Nibbana as something realizable. Because Nibbana is said to be something realizable, some are of the opinion that nothing should be predicated about it. What is the reason for this special emphasis on its realizability? It is to bring into sharp relief the point of divergence. Since the Buddha taught a way of realizing here and now something that in other religions was considered impossible. What was it that they regarded impossible to be realized? The cessation of existence, or bhava nirodha. How can one be certain here and now that this existence has ceased? This might sometimes appear as a big puzzle, but all the same, the Arahant experienced the cessation of existence as a realization. That is why he even gives expression to it as bhava nirodho nibbana. Cessation of existence is nibbana. It comes about by this extinction of influxes. The very existence of existence is especially due to the flowing in of influxes of existence. What is called existence is not the apparent process of existing visible to others. It is something that pertains to one's own mental continuum. For instance, when it is said that some person is in the world of sense desires, one might sometimes imagine it as living surrounded by objects of sense pleasures. But that is not always the case. It is the existence in a world of sense desire built up by sensuous thoughts. It is the same with the realms of form and formless realms. Even those realms can be experienced and attained while living in this world itself. Similarly, it is possible for one to realize the complete cessation of this existence while living in this very world. It is accomplished by winning to the realization that the influxes of sensual desires, existence and ignorance no longer influence one's mind. So all this goes to show the high degree of importance attached to the word āsava. The Sammadhitti Sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya seems to pose a problem regarding the significance of this term. At one place in the sutta, it is said that the rising of ignorance is due to the rising of influxes, and that the cessation of ignorance is due to the cessation of influxes. Āsava samudayo avijja samudayo. Āsava nirodha avijja nirodho. If the sutta says only this much, it will not be such a problem, because it appears as a puzzle to many nowadays why ignorance is placed first. Various reasons are adduced and arguments put forward as to why it is stated first out of the 12 factors. The fact that there is still something to precede it could therefore be some consolation. Comment. Yeah, and I'd like to note that the two Chinese Agama and Sanskrit fragment parallel to the Sammadhitti Sutta only relate the influxes to ignorance. They do not specify any cause for ignorance. So here I'm just giving the Chinese, so that is independence, or with the arising of ignorance, there are the influxes, and Sanskrit avidya samudaya and asrava samudaya. But the statement that the asava samudaya avidya samudaya, which we just heard from the Pali, has no counterpart in any of the parallel versions. End of comment. But then, a little way off in the Self-Same Sutta, we read avidya samudaya asava samudaya, avidya nirodha asava nirodha. With the rising of ignorance is the rising of influxes. With the cessation of ignorance is the cessation of influx. Apparently this contradicts the previous statement. The preacher of this discourse, Manava Sariputta, is not one who contradicts himself, though most probably there is some deep reason behind this. Another problem crops up, since ignorance is also counted among the different kinds of influxes. This makes our puzzle all the more deep. But the state of affairs could best be understood with the help of an illustration. It is in order to explain a certain fascinating behavior of the mind that even arahants of great wisdom have to make seemingly contradictory statements. Comment. Yeah, I am not sure if we need to attribute this to Venerable Sariputta and arahants making contradictory statements. I mean, in view of the situation in the parallels, we just simply cannot be sure what was the original version. Whether it was the way in the Pali version. And this has been then lost in all the parallels, or whether maybe the Pali version is simply a later development. End of comment. We have to draw in at this juncture a very important discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, which is a marvel in itself. It comes in the section on the aggregates, Khanda Samyutta, as the second Gandhula Sutta. Here the Buddha makes the following impressive declaration. Dittam vo bhikkave charanam nama chittanti evang bhante tampi ko bhikkave charanam nama chittang chitteneva chintitam tenapi ko bhikkave charanena chittena chittaneva chittataram. Das Matiya Bhikkavi Abhikkanang Sakkang Chittang Panchavekam Kittabbang Dhigarattang Idang Chittang Sankilittang Ragena Dosena Mohenati Chitta Sankilesa Bhikkave Satta Sankilissanti Chitta Vodana Satta Visudjanti Nahang Bhikkavi Anyang Ekanikayam Pisamanupassami Evang Chittang Tang yathaidang bhikkave tirachanagatapana. Tepiko bhikkave tirachanagatapana chitteneva chintita. Tepiko bhikkave tirachanagate pane chittaneva chittataran. Tasmatiya bhikkave bhikkuna abhikkanang sakkang chittang patinchavikkitabang. Digaratang idang chittang sankilit tan rāgena dosena mohenāti. Citta saṅkilesa bhikkave sattā saṅkilissanti citta buddhāna sattā visujjanti. Monks, have you seen a picture called a movie, Charana? Yes, Lord. Monks, even that picture called a movie is something thought out by the mind. But this mind, monks, is more picturesque than that picture called a movie. Therefore, monks, you should reflect moment to moment on your own mind with the thought, for a long time has this mind been defiled by lust, hate and delusion. By the defilement of the mind, monks, are beings defiled. By the purification of the mind, are beings purified. Monks, I do not see any other class of beings as picturesque as beings in the animal realm. But those beings in the animal realm, monks, are also thought out by the mind. And the mind, monks, is far more picturesque than those beings in the animal realm. Therefore, monks, should a monk reflect moment to moment on one's own mind with the thought, for a long time has this mind been defiled by lust, hate and delusion. By the defilement of the mind, monks, are beings defiled. By the purification of the mind are beings purified. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Bhikkhus, have you seen a picture called Faring On? Yes, Venerable Sir. Even that picture called Faring On has been designed in its diversity by the mind. Yet the mind is even more diverse than that picture called Faring On. Therefore, because one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred, and delusion. Through the defilement of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. Because I do not see any other order of living beings so diversified as those in the animal realm. Even those beings in the animal realm have been diversified by the mind. Yet the mind is even more diverse than those beings in the animal realm. Therefore, bhikkhus, one should often reflect upon one's own mind thus. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hatred, and delusion. Through the defilement of the mind, beings are defiled. With the cleansing of the mind, beings are purified. And I've also put in the Chinese. And it seems that the translator misunderstood this passage, and so he has added a bird, even in the passage on the Charanama Chittang, there's the transliteration, I think, of Charana. Did you see the Charana bird? Of various colors. So it seems that the original used for the Chinese translation would have been similar to the Pali, but the translator just couldn't make any sense out of it and then added a bird there. And so for somebody approaching the Chinese text without access to an Indic language parallel, it carries quite a different meaning. End of comment. Here the Buddha gives two illustrations to show how marvelous this mind is. First, he asked the monks whether they have seen a picture called Charana. Though the word may be rendered by movie, it is not a motion picture of the sort we have today. According to the commentary, it is some kind of variegated painting done on a mobile canvas chamber, illustrative of the results of good and evil karma. Whatever it may be, it seems to have been something marvelous. But far more marvelous, according to the Buddha, is this mind. The reason given is that even such a picture is something thought of by the mind. Comment: this way of teaching by carrying around paintings, I think it could also sometimes be an explanation for certain literalism. like, for example, in the later hagiography of the period before the Buddha set out for his quest of awakening, we get these stories that he was completely unaware of old age, disease and death, and then on doing outings from his palace, he came across for the first time in his life seeing somebody who was sick, etc. And the suggestion has been made by a German scholar already quite some time ago that this could have been simply started by there's a discourse actually which describes the Buddha's actual insight into the predicaments of human existence. And then in order to make this insight more easily visible, understandable in the ancient Indian setting, it would have been natural to make some drawings that show him seeing old age, disease and death. And then later on, the existence of these drawings could then have led to this actual story that he for the first time in his life saw these things, which is so out of keeping with the astute observational qualities of the Buddha to have lived for much of his youth completely oblivious of the fact that people become old and get sick and die. And so this Charanamachittan, this idea of images being made for the purpose of teaching and carried around, helps us to imagine how certain literalisms crept into the Buddhist tradition. End of comment. Then, by way of an advice to the monks, says the Buddha, therefore, monks, you should reflect on your mind moment to moment with the thought. For a long time, this mind has been defiled by lust, hate, and delusion. The moral drawn is that beings are defiled by the defilements of their minds, and that they are purified by the purification of their minds. This is the illustration by the simile of the picture. And then the Buddha goes on to make another significant declaration. Monks, I do not see any other class of beings as picturesque, as beings in the animal realm. But since those beings are also thought out by the mind, he declares that the mind is far more picturesque than them. Based on this conclusion, he repeats the same advice as before. At first sight, the sutta, when it refers to a picture, seems to be speaking about the man who drew it. But there is something deeper than that. When the Buddha says that the picture called Charana is also something thought out by the mind, he is not simply stating the fact that the artist drew it after thinking it out with his mind. The reference is rather to the mind of the one who sees it. He who sees it regards it as something marvelous. He creates a picture out of it. He imagines something picturesque in it. In fact, the allusion is not to the artist's mind, but to the spectator's mind. It is on account of the three defilements of lust, hate, and delusion, nurtured in his mind for a long time, that he is able to appreciate and enjoy that picture. Such is the nature of those influxes. That is why the Buddha declared that this mind is far more picturesque than the picture in question. So if one turns back to look at one's own mind, in accordance with the Buddha's advice, it will be a wonderful experience, like watching a movie. Why? Because reflection reveals the most marvelous sight in the world. But usually one does not like to reflect, because one has to turn back to do so. One is generally inclined to look at the thing in front. However, the Buddha advises us to turn back and look at one's own mind every moment. Why? Because the mind is more marvelous than that picture called Charana or movie. It is the same declaration that he makes with reference to the beings in the animal realm. When one comes to think about it, there's even less room for doubt here than in the case of the picture. First of all, the Buddha declares that there's no class of beings more picturesque than those in the animal realm. But he follows it up with the statement that even those beings are thought out by the mind, to draw the conclusion that as such the mind is more picturesque than those beings in the animal realm. Let us try to sort out the point of this declaration. Generally, we may agree that beings in the animal realm are the most picturesque. We sometimes say that the butterfly is beautiful, but we might hesitate to call a blue fly beautiful. The tiger is fierce, but the cat is not. Yuan's personal attitude accounts much for the concepts of beauty, ugliness, fierceness, and innocence of animals. It is because of the defiling influence of influxes, such as ignorance, that the world around us appears so picturesque. Based on this particular sutta, with its reference to the Charana picture as a prototype, we may take a peep at the modern day's movie film by way of an analogy. It might facilitate the understanding of the teachings on Paticchasamuppada and Nibbana in a way that is closer to our everyday life. The principles governing the film and the drama are part and parcel of the life outside cinema and the theatre. But since it is generally difficult to grasp in the context of the life outside, we shall now try to elucidate them with reference to the cinema and the theatre. Usually a film or a drama is shown at night. The reason for it is the presence of darkness. This darkness helps to bring out the darkness of ignorance that dwells in the minds of beings. So the film as well as the drama is presented to the public within a framework of darkness. If a film is shown at daytime, as a matinee show, it necessitates closed windows and dark curtains. In this way, films and dramas are shown within a curtained enclosure. There's another strange thing about these films and dramas. One goes to the cinema or the theatre saying, I'm going to see a film show, I'm going to see a drama. And one returns saying, I've seen a film show, I've seen a drama. But while the film show or the drama is going on, one forgets that one is seeing a show or a drama. Such a strange spell of delusion takes over. This is due to the intoxicating influence of influxes. If one wishes to enjoy a film show or a drama, one should be prepared to get intoxicated by it. Otherwise, it will cease to be a film show or a drama for him. What do the film producers and dramatists do? They prepare the background for eliciting the influxes of ignorance latent in the minds of the audience. That is why such shows and performances are held at night. Or else dark curtains are employed. They have an intricate job to do. Within the framework of darkness, they have to create a delusion in the minds of their audience, so as to enact some story in a realistic manner. To be successful, a film or a drama has to be given a touch of realism. Though fictitious, it should be apparently real for the audience. There is an element of deception involved, a hoodwink. For this touch of realism, quite a lot of makeup on the part of actors and actresses is necessary. As a matter of fact, in the ancient Indian society, one of the primary senses of the word sankara was the makeup done by actors and actresses. Now, in the present context, sankara can include not only this makeup in personal appearance, but also the acting itself, the delineation of character, stagecraft, etc. In this way, the film producers and dramatists create a suitable environment, making use of the darkness and the makeup contrivances. These are the sankaras, or the preparations. However, to be more precise, it is the audience that make preparations in the last analysis. Here too, as before, we are compelled to make a statement that might appear strange. So far, not a single cinema has held a film show, and not a single theatre has staged a drama. And yet, those who had gone to the cinema and the theatre had seen film shows and dramas. Now, how can that be? Usually we think that it is the film producer who produces the film and that it is the dramatist who makes the drama. But if we are to understand the deeper implications of what the Buddha declared with reference to the picture Chadana, a film show or drama is produced in the last analysis by the spectator himself. When he goes to the cinema and the theatre, he takes with him the spices needed to concoct a film or drama, and that is the influxes or asavas. Whatever technical defects and shortcomings there are in them, he makes good with his influxes. As we know, in a drama, there's a certain interval between two scenes, but the average audience is able to appreciate even such a drama, because they are influenced by the influxes of sense desire, existence and ignorance. With the progress in science and technology, scenes are made to fall on the screen with extreme rapidity. All the same, the element of delusion is still there. The purpose is to create the necessary environment for arousing delusion in the minds of the audience. Whatever preparations others may make, if the audience does not respond with their own preparations along the same lines, the drama will not be a success. But in general, the worldlings have a tendency to prepare and concoct, so they would make up for any shortcomings in the film or the drama with their own preparations and enjoy them. Now, for instance, let us think of an occasion when a film show is going on within the framework of darkness. In the case of a matinee show, doors and windows will have to be closed. Supposing the doors are suddenly flung open while a vivid technicolor scene is flashing on the screen. What happens then? The spectators will find themselves suddenly thrown out of the cinema world they had created for themselves. Why? Because the scene in technicolor has now lost its color, it has faded away. The result is dejection, disenchantment. The film show loses its significance. That film show owed its existence to the dark framework of ignorance and the force of preparations. But now that the framework has broken down, such a vast change has come over, resulting in a disenchantment. Now the word raga has nuance suggestive of color. So viraga, dispassion, can also literally mean a fading away or a decoloration. Here we have a possible instance of nibbida, viraga, disenchantment, dispassion, at least in a limited sense. A door suddenly flung open can push aside the delusion, at least temporarily. Let us consider the implications of this little event. The film show, in this case, ceases to be a film show because of a flash of light coming from outside. Now, what would have happened if this flash of light had come from within? From within one's mind. Then also something similar would have happened. If the light of wisdom dawns on one's mind while watching a film show or a drama, one would even wonder whether it is actually a film or a drama, while others are enjoying it. Speaking about the film show, we mentioned above that the spectator has entered into a world of his own creation. If we are to analyze this situation according to the law of dependent origination, we may add that in fact he has a consciousness and a name and form in line with the events of the story, based on the preparations in the midst of the darkness of ignorance. With all his experiences in seeing the film show, he is building up his five aggregates. Therefore, when the light of wisdom comes and dispels the darkness of ignorance, a similar event can occur. One will come out of that plane of existence. One will step out of the world of sense desires, at least temporarily. Now, with regards to the Arahant's tomb, the same trend of events holds good. when their ignorance ceases, leaving no residue. Avijjaya tveva sesa viraga niruddha. Exhausting the influxes as well, preparations also cease. Why? Because the preparations owe their existence to ignorance. They have the ability to prepare so long as there is ignorance. Sankhara generally means preparations. It is the makeup and the make-believe which accounted for the delusion. The darkness of ignorance provided the setting for it. If somehow or other the light of wisdom enters the scene, those preparations, sankhara, become no preparations, visankhara, and the prepared, sankata, becomes a non-prepared, asankata. So what was true with regard to the film show is also true in a deeper sense with regard to the events leading up to the attainment of Arahanthood. With the dawn of that light of wisdom, the preparations of sankhara lose their significance and become visankhara. Though for the world outside they appear as preparations, for the Arahant they are not preparations, because they do not prepare a bhava or existence for him. They are made ineffective. Similarly, the prepared or the made up, when it is understood as something prepared or made up, becomes an unprepared or an unmade. There is a subtle principle of undoing involved in this. Sometimes this might be regarded as a modernistic interpretation, but there is canonical evidence in support of such an interpretation. For instance, in the Dvayatthanupassana Sutta of the Sutta Nipata, we come across the following verse. Nivutanam tamohoti andhakaro apassatan satancha vivattam hoti aloko pasatthamiva santike navijjananti maga dhammas akkuvida. Murk it is to those enveloped as darkness unto the undiscerning, but to the good wide open it is, as light is unto those discerning. So near, and yet they know not, fools unskilled in the know. Comment, translation by Bhikkhu Bodhi. There is gloom for those who are blocked, darkness for those who do not see. But for the good it is opened up, like light for those who see. The brutes unskilled in the Dhamma do not understand it even when close. End of comment. It is all murky to those enveloped by the hindrance of ignorance, like the darkness for those who are unable to see. But for the noble ones, it is visible like an open space, even as the light to those with vision. Though it is near at hand, fools, inexpert in the Dhamma, do not understand. This same impression of the Buddha comes up again in the following verse in the Uddana. Moha sambandha no loko bhambarupova disati upadhi bandhan no balo tamasa parivarito sasatori vakhayati pasato nakti kinchanam. The world, in fetter to delusion, feigns a promising mean. The fool to his assets bound sees only darkness around. It looks as though it would last, but to him who sees there is not. Comment, translation by Ireland. The world is held in bondage by delusion and only appears to be capable to a fool, held in bondage by clinging, and wrapped up in ignorance. It appears to be eternal, but one who sees has no obstructions. End of comment. The world appears as real to one who is fettered to delusion. He imagines it to be reliable. And so the fool, relying on his assets, is encompassed by the darkness. To him the world appears as eternal. But the one who has the right vision knows that in reality there is nothing. All this goes to show that the life outside is not much different from what goes on within the four walls of the cinema and the theater. Just as in the latter case, an enjoyable story is created out of a multitude of scenes, relayed at varying degrees of rapidity, backed up by the delusive makeup of actors and actresses, so that one may lose oneself in a world of fantasy. Even so, according to the point of view of Dhamma, the lifestyle outside is something made up and concocted. However, the darkness within is much thicker than the darkness outside. The darkness outside may be dispelled even by a door flung open, as we saw above, but not so easily the darkness within. That is why in the Psalms of the Theras and Theries, it is said that they split or burst asunder the mass of delusion. Tamokkhandang padhalaya, tamokkhandang padhalayin. The pitchy black darkness of ignorance in the world is one that is thick enough to be split up and burst asunder. So it seems the darkness within is almost tangibly thick. But the first incision on this thick curtain of darkness is made by the path knowledge of the stream within. As a sidelight, we may cite an episode from the lives of the Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana, the two chief disciples of the Buddha. Formerly as Brahmin youths, they were known as Upatissa and Kulita. These two young men once went to see a hilltop festival called Giragga Samanja. Since by then their discerning wisdom was already matured, they suddenly developed a dejection about the entertainment going on. The hilltop festival, as it were, lost its festivity for them. They understood the vanity of it and could no longer enjoy it as before. They may have already had a distant glimpse of the similarity between the two levels of experience mentioned above. But they on their own could not get at the principles underlying the delusion involved. Much later, as a wandering ascetic, when Upatissa met the Venerable Asaji Thera on his alms round, he begged the latter to preach the Dhamma to him. Venerable Asaji said, "I know only a little." Upatissa also assured him, "I need only a little." Venerable Asaji preached a little, and Upatissa too heard a little. But since there was much in it, the latter attained the fruit of streamini, even on hearing the first two lines of the following verse. Ye dhamma hetu pabhava, tesam hetam tathagato aha, tesam chayo nirodho, evam vadi mahasamano. Of things that proceed from a cause, their cause the Tathagata has told, and also their cessation, thus teaches the great ascetic. The verse gives in a nutshell the law of dependent arising. From it, Upatissa got the clue to his riddle of life. Some interpret the word hetu, cause, in this verse as avidya or ignorance, the first link. But that is not the case. It refers to the basic principle known as idapachyata, the relatedness of this to that. Hetu pabhava dhamma is a reference to things dependently arisen. In point of fact, it is said about a stream runner that he has seen well the cause as well as the things arisen from a cause. Hetu cha sudito, hetu samuppanna cha dhamma. That means that he has seen the law of dependent arising as also the dependently arisen phenomenon. We have already discussed the significance of these two terms. What is called paticca-samuppada is the basic principle itself. It is said that the wandering ascetic Upatissa was able to arouse the path of streaming on hearing just the first two lines. And they state the basic principle as such. Comment: I am not sure on what this is based, that he attained streaming on hearing just the first two lines. I checked in the commentary and I was not able to find anything in this respect. what is generally known is that he became a student on hearing the entire verse. But anyway, this is perhaps not of much importance. End of comment. The word tesang, plural, clearly implies that the reference is to all the 12 factors, inclusive of ignorance. The cessation also is of those 12. As for instance, it is said in Udana, Kayam Pachayanam Avivi, understood the cessation of conditions, since all the 12 are conditions. To sum up, whatever phenomena that arise from a cause, the cause is either Pachayata, or the law of relatedness of this to that. This being, this exists. With the rising of this, this arises. This not being, this does not exist. With the cessation of this, this ceases. And then the cessation of things arisen from a cause is ultimately Nibbana itself. That is the implication of the often recurrent phrase avijjaya tveva asesa viraga nirodha, with the complete fading away and cessation of that very ignorance. So then, from this discussion, it should be clear that our illustration with the help of the simile of the cinema and the theatre is of much relevance to an understanding of the law of dependent arising. With this much, we shall wind up today. Comment? Yeah, the salient point I identify in particular the second part of the sermon, as the first part was still operating on the topic of Nisaya Nisita from the last sermon, are the influxes, the asavas, and then the very apt illustration of their influence with the simile of the cinema inspired by the Garuda Sutta, the Charanama Chittang, the representation by a canvas, and the nature of the mind, the impact, the contribution of the mind, in particular the influxes in the mind, to creating a movie or a drama. And this is a very powerful image. Thank you very much for your attention.